alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint,
a critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and my dear guest, Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah. Assalamu alaikum, Sayyid Abdullah, and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
My pleasure to have you back in the studio, as well as you, Brother Hussein.
Assalamu alaikum, I'm glad to be here.
Well, we were talking about the movie Gemini Man from the last episode on, based on the topic that we chose from fairly a long time ago. We were, in fact, shifting from one movie to another because we were talking about this topic, this very important topic of cloning. And there are some serious questions remaining about the morality of the issue under question, under investigation. I mean, cloning. Let me start with you, Brother Hussein. What do you think of the morality of cloning? Is cloning, generally speaking, moral, ethical to develop and do it to human beings, not only to animals or plants, as we can see, like genetically modified food, for example, or products? So they have already done it to some vegetables or agricultural products, in addition to animals. But what about human beings?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So cloning in Islam is a fairly new topic. I think, you know, it has a very wide range of, you know, points that we have to cover. So cloning itself, I feel like it's ethical only A, if the person consents, and B, if the subject, you know, doesn't get harmed, I guess, or isn't harmed. But that's pretty much it. Really, there is no... you can't just delete memories, for example, without permission, or modify things beyond benefit of, you know, the general public. Like, for example, in the movie Replicas, they were making clones so that they can use them for the purpose of, you know, war, so they can use them as weapons,
mm-hmm.
as the boss admits,
yes.
to the doctor. So, of course, that would be wrong, but if you're using them for the good, if you're using them to make, like, doctors, engineers, people who are actually going to impact the world positively, then I guess there is a way that you can make it work.
Mm-hmm. I see. Sayyid Abdullah, what do you think of morality, or whether cloning, generally speaking, being moral? Do you think that there are certain criteria that we can put in there and say that, for example, as Brother Hussein was referring to, like if it puts the person or other people in a harm way, if it provides the benefits for the others, then it makes it moral or immoral?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There are two things here, right? Two issues here. There is the jurisprudential aspect, whether it's halal or haram, mm-hmm. allowed or forbidden.
Yes.
And there's the moral aspect of it. If you want my personal opinion is one thing, if you want Islam opinion is another thing as well.
I see.
As far as my opinion is concerned, when it comes to cloning, it's always a question of why. Like, it's not a moral issue. It's more of why would you want to have a clone? Right? Why would you want to have a replica of yourself, someone that looks like you? Obviously, we expressed the point enough that you cannot have a person that is exactly you in and out, because mm-hmm. you would have to have a copy of your soul too, which said that's impossible. Yes. So you can have someone identical to you in terms of biology, right? So why would you want to have someone that looks like you? In terms, for example, if you're in Japan and other countries, they were able to, like you said, copy vegetables, or they copy rats and copy other creatures, and it succeeded. It's yes. successful. They can reproduce different form of life forms that are identical mm-hmm. in looks.
Yes.
They can do that. So if I want to have a child that looks like me, it's a question of why, not whether it's moral or not moral. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So this is the thing. So if you ask me, is it moral to me? Well, I say it depends on the person. Yes. Like, you know, why would you want to have a clone? If it makes sense to you, if this is what you like, then by all means. It's not a yes. matter of a moral value. But if you look at it from an Islamic perspective, obviously the answer will change and would differ.
Mm-hmm. I would ask you some more questions regarding that, but sure. in the second part of our episode. Let's take a break.
Don't you think your country deserves a perfect version of you?
There is no perfect version of me, or him, or anybody.
No. He was on his way to Yemen. Now, thanks to you, his place is going to be taken by someone with parents. Someone who feels pain, fear, which we had edited out of him. Someone with just as many weaknesses as the terrorists that we're trying to kill. And you're going to tell me that's better?
So why not make a whole army of them?
Yeah, why not? Think how many American families we could spare. Nobody's son or daughter would ever have to die. No vet comes home with PTSD and kills himself. We can keep the whole world safe without any actual grief. So who would I be hurting?
Back to the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. We were talking about Gemini Man. Sayyid Abdullah, you raised very serious issues. Like you said that when I asked you the question of morality, whether it is ethical to have a copy of you or something like that, you said it's a question of why, not first like religion or jurisprudence mm. or something like that, or even morality. Well, how do you defer these things? And also, you also deferred it and distinguished it from the question of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
I know that morality or the realm of ethics is quite different from jurisprudence.
Mm.
All right? And these could go different ways, or they could overlap, by the way, in some,
yeah.
for example, some areas. Cases. Yeah. Mm. All right? So how do you define these differences? Would you give us more examples? You also said it's a question of why.
Mm.
All right? And if we pass that question,
mm.
all right? Like, for example, we wanted to, let's say, have a copy of Albert Einstein,
mm.
a scientist, or Ibn Sina,
mm.
or these.
But only his looks, though.
But what about their brain? What about their smartness?
You can't.
Intelligence.
The intelligence is not in their brain, not in the actual organ. So you're not going to have a copy of Einstein with his knowledge. You're going to have a copy of the body of Einstein. So you're going to have a twin, basically. So when you have two twins, identical twins, they look identical, but the inside is completely different. The way they think is completely different. Their intellect is completely different. Their IQ is completely different.
But you're comparing some natural identical twins, with something which is unnatural, something which is being manipulated by man, something manipulated in a way that they can make it better, stronger, like Gemini Man.
Yeah, so like I said, sometimes we're talking hypothetical.
Yes.
Science fiction, that's one thing. Sometimes we're talking about real life, that's another thing. Because you have to understand that any matter that comes to Islam, right, Islam has to look at it from the perspective of its reality, it's being done or it could be done,
yes.
or can I do it? Islam will only look at it if it can take place on the outside. If it's just a hypothetical science fiction, Islam would not touch it, would not even come to it. You know mm-hmm. what I mean?
Yes.
So unless it's can be applied. So for example, you said, okay, we take Einstein DNA, we go to his grave, we dig his grave, we take a hair, we take his DNA, and we can reproduce through the normal process another human, right?
Mm-hmm.
That he will look like Einstein. But would it be Einstein himself? Not what. Would he carry some of Einstein's smartness or geniuses? There's a possibility.
There's a possibility, but, and that's the purpose.
Yeah,
of the
so there's a possibility, but would it give you this? Because you have to understand that the brain, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave it to you as a vegetable, just nothing, just plain. Like in replicas where he said the brain was empty, and if you leave it, it will grow in 20 days. He said the body would grow,
yes.
It will age dramatically. So therefore, he needed to sedate the body so the brain stops functioning, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have the fresh brain, Allah gives it to you, and then Allah puts the soul, and the soul uses the brain to produce information. So my brain, your brain, and brother Hussein's brain, all the same brain. The only difference between our brain is that machine that operates, which is the soul. So if Einstein's soul is not there, whatever rider that will take that body, he will not use it in the same way Einstein did. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So even if we give him the strengths, even if we give him, we manipulate the DNA to be the best, that person, the soul that will take, inhabit that body,
mm-hmm.
maybe he will say, you know what, stop this, I don't want to be a scientist, I want to, just play games and have fun.
Or a gangster.
Or a gangster, So
that would be a dangerous gangster.
Yeah, so
Albert Einstein was
going to be a smart gangster.
This is
the thing, this is the dilemma we're working here with.
Thank you very much. Let's take another break and we'll be back.
The Gemini lab's been dismantled. Cloning program is history.
And Junior?
He's untouchable. No one will bother him. Ever. And we checked. There are no more clones.
What about you?
IG called. I'm looking at charges, but if I marry Janet, I can make a deal.
Back to the program Viewpoint. The movie critique program on IRIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program, and my dear guests, as always, are still Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Hussein. Brother Hussein, do you agree with what Sayyid Abdullah was saying in the earlier part of our program?
Yes.
I asked him the question that you asked the question of why, and then I said, well, you can have like Albert Einstein or somebody else like Isaac Newton or some of these scientists like Ibn Sina copied and continue with them, and the whole the whole world would change with these scientists and science developing, you know.
Yeah. So in terms of physical attributes, we've already agreed that we can, in this current world, we can clone people to look like others, right? Like we can take the strongest man on earth,
mm-hmm.
we can clone him and he'll turn out the exact same.
Yes.
Well, not the exact same. Well, actually, yeah, maybe. He'd have to go through the same mental, I guess, processes, and he'd have to learn exactly like how to keep his body healthy, how to exercise every day. But yes, other than that, if you're trying to clone a person like Einstein, we've already agreed that we can't clone the soul. So if we can copy his mind, which we probably can't, but if we can, then yes, I guess it would be a successful experiment. But
what was Sayyid Abdullah talking about was that we cannot create the soul, and what's the driving force behind everybody, even the brain of Albert Einstein, even if you copy another person, another individual, that would not be exactly the same Albert Einstein you expect it to be.
Yeah.
So because you cannot create the soul, you cannot put the soil there, or
if you could
clone the soul.
If you could create the soul,
that would be another story. Then that's what Sayyid Abdullah was saying, that it's a possibility. Maybe in very distant future, or maybe in near
the soul?
Future. Yes.
Well,
no,
if
the soul
you look is not
at
a possibility.
It,
you cannot copy the soul.
Yes.
Yeah, but according to the question, if you look at it from a scientific perspective, like or an atheist perspective. You think, okay, well, we have the mind and we have the body, okay? If we are, like, in that movie, replicas, if we can clone both, then, yeah, still, there will be differences. For example, This Albert Einstein would be interested in mathematics, physics, science, whatever. But the other one might not be interested in the same thing, because, you know, it really depends on his personality, which is something that you can't clone. You know, you can't clone what the mind is, what you know, how he thinks or what he thinks about. Those are things that are very random, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you, Brother Hussein, and thank you, Sayyid Abdullah, for your contribution to the program, Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the movie Gemini Man and some related issues such as cloning. Thank you very much for listening to this program. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Muharram Special. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, staged his uprising to revive the Prophet's practice and confront evilness. He sacrificed his life and all his belongings to safeguard human values and spirituality. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, O people, this Hussein is the son of Ali. Recognize him. I swear by the one which my soul is in his hand, that he and his lovers and lovers of his lovers will be in paradise. Imam Hussein's aim of uprising was to safeguard the divine values and protect the traditions of the Prophet of Islam. He spared no effort to revive the forgotten values of Islam. That's why the Muslim scholars believe that Islam owed its foundation to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and survival to Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Ignorance and oppression had covered the Islamic rules like dust after the passing away of the Prophet. The martyrdom of Imam Hussein and his loyal companions removed this dust and demonstrated the real image of Islam. This is what we read in Ziyarat, or standard form of salutation to Imam Hussein. I bear testimony that you indeed maintained the prayer and enjoined what is good and forbade what is evil. Basically, enjoining what is good and forbidding what is evil have a very high position in the culture of the Ahlul Bayt, or the progeny of the Prophet. Imam Ali, peace upon him, calls this obligatory act as superior to jihad, or a struggle in the way of God. He says, all good deeds and jihad in the way of God before enjoining what is good and forbidding what is evil are like a drop before a turbulent and vast sea. Imam Hussein believed that he had to support Islamic values with all his being. His personality was the incarnation of steadfastness and freedom. He staged his uprising to show to mankind that he would never surrender to oppression under any circumstances. He would never compromise with the despotic and licentious rulers of Umayyad regime. He used to quote these words from his father, Imam Ali: "The most unjust man is the one who promotes traditions of oppression in the society and destroys just traditions." Imam Hussein, peace upon him, had an iron will. In response to his brother, Muhammad Hanafiye, who had proposed some peaceful ways for him to avoid military confrontation with Yazid, the Imam said, "My brother, if there remains no refuge and safe haven on the earth, I will never swear allegiance with Yazid, son of Muawiyah." In the sublime culture of Imam Hussein, humility and submission before untruth and injustice has no place. His word keeps resonating in the ears of history when he said, "Beware that the illegitimate brat, the son of the illegitimate brat, Ubaidullah, son of Ziyad, has forced me to choose one of the two, either death or humility." Humility is far from us. God, his apostle, the faithful, the chaste lapse, the valorous people, and the people of the noble world do not accept from us to prefer the obedience of the base to death with dignity. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, sacrificed his blood to dignify Islam and the school of the Ahlul Bayt. In Karbala, he depicted the picture of self-sacrifice and safeguarding the pristine Islamic values. His uprising caused wise people to become more aware of oppression and corruption. He made them move against injustice rather than being indolent and inactive. After the epic of Ashura, many people staged uprisings to avenge Imam's blood. For instance, Mukhtar Saqafi staged a great uprising whereby he killed many of the perpetrators of Karbala. In the contemporary era too, revolutions and movements have been staged through taking the pattern of Ashura and Imam Hussein's uprising. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, staged his uprising to expose the tarnished image of Islam that Yazid and his cohorts had depicted of this religion. He fought against Yazid knowing that he and all his 72 companions would be slain. He taught us that we should sacrifice whatever we have to preserve the divine values and God's religion.
This is A to Z.
Today's lesson, Invitation to the Imam. The distinguished supporters of Imam Ali alayhi salam gathered in the house of Sulaiman bin Suradeh Khadai and thanked Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for the death of Muawiyah. Sulaiman then said, addressing those present, Muawiyah has departed from the world, and Husayn ibn Ali has declined to take the oath of allegiance to Yazid and has gone to Mecca. You are the supporters of Husayn as well as of his father Ali. If you think that you are ready to assist him and to fight against his enemy and can lay down your lives for his sake, you should inform him of your readiness through a letter. In case, however, you are scared that you will show slackness and will abstain from rendering him assistance, you should not deceive him by claiming unduly to be his supporters and devotees. So the scenario is that Muawiyah has died, Yazid has come into power, Imam Husayn alayhi salam is being forced to pledge the oath of allegiance at the hand of Yazid, and these followers of Ahlul Bayt, especially the supporters of Imam Ali alayhi salam, they gathered in this house of Sulaiman ibn Suradeh Khudai, right? And this is where Sulaiman said these words. So keep this whole picture in mind, and hopefully you can foresee, you know, what is going to happen because you know the history. But we are going to derive some lessons for ourselves after the break when we come back.
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
As-salamu alaykum.
Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are talking about the invitation Imam Husayn alayhi salam was given, the letters that were written, and we painted a picture for you through a historical account from the history of Karbala, where the companions of Ahlul Bayt, the lovers and devotees of Ahlul Bayt, they got together to support Imam Husayn alayhi salam. So let's try to draw some lessons from that historical account. Lesson number one is, thank Allah when a tyrant dies. You know, one of the very important things is that throughout our lives, we should have no healthy relationship with the enemies of Islam. Those known enemies of Islam, like today, if you look at the United States of America, its government and its agencies, you know, the governmental apparatus. A believer, a mu'min, a Shia of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam should try to stay away from having any relationships with such entities. When a tyrant dies, the believers thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. As we see in this historical account, when Muawiyah died, all of these supporters of Imam Ali alayhi salam gathered in the house of Sulaiman to thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Lesson number two. Assist the righteous servants of God when you witness them being on the right path. So when these people saw that Imam Husayn alayhi salam, he has done the uprising against the evil of the time, the aggressor and the oppressor of the time, it was clear for them that he requires support. You cannot just sit on the sidelines and watch a battle between Haq and Batil while you're not part of that battle. The battle between good and bad,
the battle between righteousness and falsehood needs to be fought by the believers. Lesson number three, don't give false promises. Don't call the Imam of the time if you're not ready. This is one of the issues and one of the takeaways that we see in Karbala. Imam Hussein alayhi salam received letters from people, the Kufans, and Imam alayhi salam strategized based on those letters. But they were false promises. And in upcoming episodes, we will dissect what those promises were and whether their intentions were good or not. But that's the secondary thing right now. The first and foremost thing is, do not make promises to the divine servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala if you cannot fulfill them. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
Mary Trump's new book, The Reckoning, describes a U.S. trauma worsened by her uncle. The Reckoning argues that the United States is suffering a national trauma manifest in rising levels of rage and hatred and exacerbated by her uncle's assault on democracy. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by David Smith Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Trump was in pain and afraid during post-COVID display of bravado, Nisa's book says. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Donald Trump was afraid when he put on a display of bravado at the White House after being treated for a severe coronavirus infection, his estranged niece Mary Trump has claimed. The then U.S. president had a pained expression that Mary recognized from her grandmother, but he dared not admit his fear even to himself, she writes in a scathing new book. The Reckoning argues that the United States is suffering a national trauma manifest in rising levels of rage and hatred, and exacerbated by her uncle's assault on democracy. It follows the psychologist's memoir, Too Much and Never Enough, which portrayed Trump as the product of a dysfunctional family. Doing his best Mussolini imitation, my uncle took off his mask in a macho display of invulnerability. He jutted out his jaw, just as my grandfather did when she was clamping down on her pain. A part of the book reads, last October, Trump was discharged from a military hospital after 3 days of treatment and made a typically theatrical return to the White House, landing on the South Lawn and climbing a grand exterior staircase to the Truman balcony. Mary writes, doing his best Mussolini imitation, he took off his mask in a macho display of invulnerability. He clenched his teeth and jutted out his jaw. She adds, I have asthma, so I am acutely aware of what it looks like when somebody is struggling to breathe. He was in pain. He was afraid. But he would never admit that to anybody, not even himself, because, as always, the consequences of admitting vulnerability were much more frightening to him than being honest. For all the outward show, Trump was more severely ill than the White House admitted at the time, with depressed blood oxygen levels and a lung problem associated with pneumonia, according to a February report in the New York Times. Some officials were worried that he would need to put on a ventilator. Mary Eviscrates, Trump's handling of the coronavirus pandemic and reflecting on his turbulent presidency, links his unrestricted anti-Semitism and homophobia to deadly violence in the United States and beyond. She argues that while the president was incompetent, others in his administration built a lean and ruthless machine for advancing fascism. Mary Trump, who is 56, has become one of her uncle's most trenchant critics. She says she does not love him. She has written memorably about family dinners in the Trump household, highlighting the coldness of her psychopath grandfather, Fred, who was Donna's father. Mary voted for Clinton in 2016 election and last spoke to Donna at her aunt's birthday at the White House in April 2017. At the point that Mary was in the worst psychological shake of her life, she writes in the book, and several months later, she sought treatment at a center in Tucson, Arizona, that specialized in post-traumatic stress disorder. She said, "I would there for weeks, excavating decades-old wounds and trying to figure out why my Uncle Donna's elevation to the White House had so undone me." She was desperate to remain anonymous at the center, where, fortunately, people did not reveal their last names. Even so, I found it unthinkable that anyone should find out who I was, or, more relevantly, who my uncle was. Long before my uncle had centered the political realm, I had never admitted to anyone that I belonged to the Trump family, Mary added. With Too Much and Never Enough, which sold nearly a million copies on its first day of publication, Mary became the first member of the family to publish a Donna Trump biography. She has since been a frequent interviewee on U.S. cable news and vocal supporter of Joe Biden's 2020 election campaign against Trump. In The Reckoning, she widens the lens, contending that it is almost impossible to grow up white in America and not be racist, and that Trump is the symptom of a disease that has existed in the body politic from the United States' inception, but that has now metastasized. She adds a stark warning. From increasing levels of rage and hatred on the one side to increasing levels of helplessness, stress, and despair on the other, we are heading toward an even darker period in the United States history.
Meaningful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
And people may change, but the goals and the framework are fixed. A senior lawmaker, Amui, said this in reference to the Rouhani-Raisi transition and the fate of the JCPOA. Indeed, the new Iranian president, Raisi, did pledge to get international sanctions lifted, as he pledged to improve ties with neighboring countries and unite the country's political factions. And he realizes the straight path to sanctions relief is the revival of the JCPOA or Iran nuclear deal signed in 2015 under former President Rouhani, a moderate. But the new principalists in office may take a harder stance in verifying U.S. good faith and sanctions relief before leading the country into full recommitment to the deal. For a look at Iran's 13th government and how it may steer the JCPOA, with the U.S. steering in the opposite direction at times, stay with me, Leila Faromarzi, on Iran Today. JCPOA revival talks in Vienna began in April, but are suspended for weeks as they go on to a seventh round, because Iran is in a state of transition as a new government takes hold. It's been called a state of suspended animation, as talks will pick up to go one of two ways. According to most foreign media outlets, the way for them to go is for Iran to return to commitment to the deal or to surrender to U.S. demand. Feel free to call it hilarious, as Iran never left the deal. Mr. Ghaffari explains who is legally and logically liable, with a look at provisions in the JCPOA or Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action itself. He is a senior writer on Jame Jam Daily, who received us amid Journalist Day celebrations at his paper. That would be on the 8th of August. World media tends to point the finger at Iran. Iran must recommit to the JCPOA, but it wasn't Iran that left the JCPOA to begin with. Do make a point of this.
We are currently a member of the JCPOA, but the US isn't. This makes matters more clear. A former member who has withdrawn from participation in the deal must meet some very clear preconditions. The preconditions have been communicated to the American side during six rounds of talks in Vienna, indirectly by Washington's European allies, as well as China and Russia. These include issues such as providing a guarantee about the future of the JCPOA, verification of the US return to the deal, guarantees about the removal of all sanctions under the agreement, and the cooperation with the IAEA about Iran's research and development program in the field of peaceful nuclear technology. These are technical and legal matters that have been explained fully to the American side.
The U.S. began passing laws in breach of the JCPOA right after its signing. Then later, on May the 8th, 2018, former U.S. President Trump binned the deal and accused Iran of lying. Just the following day, the international nuclear watchdog chief noted again that Iran is meeting the terms of the agreement. Even the then U.S. Secretary of State himself, Mike Pompeo, admitted that there was no evidence Iran was in violation of the agreement. It bears the conclusion there was no legitimate basis for Trump to pull out and reimpose sanctions. By today, the nuclear watchdog, or IAEA, has confirmed 16 times that Iran was and is in full compliance with the deal. Iran signed the deal with six world powers for relief from economic, nuclear-related UN sanctions against this country. This would help it boost its oil exports and economy, and in return, Iran would limit its nuclear program. But Trump unilaterally pulled out of the nuclear deal and reimposed and reinforced UN sanctions, now as US sanctions. rooting for bringing our oil sales down to zero. Iran waited a year for Europeans to execute a way round what was now U.S. sanctions, but to no avail. Seems pretty obvious in whose field the ball is, but common sense and right and wrong aside, how do the prospects of the Vienna talks look practically? Mr. Amoui is spokesman for the Parliamentary National Security Committee. We got to meet him at his private office. How much prospect do you see for a JCPOA revival? In whose field is the ball?
The question of whether the JCPOA can be revived as a limited and substantive agreement must be answered by the Americans. Iran is still a party to the deal. It has reduced its commitments to the accord using one of the mechanisms cited inside the very same deal. But the American side has withdrawn its participation from it. If they believe that Iran must go back to full compliance and scale back its response, they have to fulfill Tehran's demand, which is the removal of sanctions.
Whatever the present situation and prospects of talks, their very existence means the JCPOA, a deal between Iran and the West, is still on the table. That is a pure example of contradiction with the fact that the West has tried to topple Iran's greater government time and again.
For example, the American side has stated that a clause should be included in the JCPOA revival agreement that would stipulate we must enter into negotiations over our regional issues and missile defense matters in a few months with the United States and Europe. Here we have a legal argument. We are saying that if you consider the JCPOA as an independent legal variable, we shouldn't tie it to other matters. If you don't, there's no need to talk about being committed to the multilateral agreement anyway. This is a paradox that must be resolved by the American officials themselves.
In facing triple challenges and triple challenges times three with an economy resisting but suffering U.S. sanctions paired with the corona crisis and drought and dried up rivers, Raisi has the opportunity of a fresh start. To his inauguration ceremony of 5th August 2021, came senior officials from East and West. The European Union, for one, sent a senior delegation that included Enrique Mora, one of the coordinators of the nuclear talks. On the other hand, leaders of the Palestinian resistance group Hamas and Lebanon's Hezbollah were in attendance. And some attendees took the opportunity to hold talks with Iranian officials on the sidelines of the ceremony. America's partners in the nuclear deal, the biggest of whom are the Western Europeans, rejected Trump's plan to use sanctions to coerce Iran into accepting new terms upon his pullout over 3 years ago. And Iran agreed to adhere to the terms of the agreement. But if the EU, Russia, and China could deliver economic incentives, the Europeans, in contrast to America, understood that Trump's violation of the deal would undermine broader efforts to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons, although they have themselves practically followed in the US footsteps up to a point. I did ask whether it wouldn't be a better policy for Iran to go its step for step with the US, but it's not easy to blame this country for wanting to verify a full removal of sanctions before recommitting. That's to say, before scaling down its peaceful nuclear program, which it's entitled to under the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which Iran is party to. This country will no longer accept U.S. excuses that it has to impose long-term sanctions on Iran because of this or that law. Laws that are all in violation of Article 29 of the deal. Say the Iran Sanctions Act, ISA, and visa and U-turn regulations, and the Qatsa law, given as everyone knows that big companies are not willing to invest in a country for 6 months or less duration. CATSA stands for Countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions Act. Right and wrong aside, realistically looking at the bigger picture, where do you see JCPOA Vienna talks leading? Do you see the JCPOA being revived?
Regardless of the flaws, ambiguities, and the nature of the agreement, it was legally ratified by all permanent and non-permanent members of the UN Security Council as a common ground based on multilateralism in the international system. And UN Resolution 2231 was issued to enshrine the deal. Well, here, if we want to step back from this definitive document and put a step-by-step approach on the agenda, it means that we have disregarded a strong agreement.
Right after the JCPOA became operational, its implementation was not perfect. In early 2016, the U.S. Congress passed, by veto-proof majorities, legislation that required Europeans and others who had traveled to Iran to get visas to go to the U.S. This negatively affected Iran's ability to attract Western investors. Mr. Qadiri is a political analyst and journalist of long standing, an old pen, so to speak. Let's hear him out.
I call it economic terrorism or scientific terrorism in the sense that you have banned our scientists too. Why have you denied our scientists access so they can build what they need inside the country? We faced this problem, especially during the coronavirus pandemic. They didn't allow Iran access to the WHO's international COVAX vaccine basket, even though Iran had paid for the jabs in advance and was in line to receive them. This ugly behavior was exhibited for other countries too.
Iran demands the U.S. must, in accordance with Article 29 of the JCPOA, lift all the obstacles in the way of normalizing Iran's trade ties with world countries. It must lift all sanctions imposed under any title after the JCPOA took effect, whether during the term of Trump or that of his predecessor, Barack Obama. And all the JCPOA articles should be precisely implemented. Plenty more on the result of Trump and Congress's actions and how Raisi might handle them. But first, allow me to introduce Sarah to the show for a quick media review.
Hello and welcome to the news part of the show with me, Sarah Adema. Today I'm going to walk you through different media outlets and their reviews regarding the JCPOA, or the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Let's get right into it. Our first piece of news comes from Tehran Times that begins with the headline, Iran says JCPOA is not over. Khatibzadeh, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman, at his press briefing, which was held online, responded to some statement made inside the United States that Washington should not allow the new Iranian president and his entourage to attend the United Nations General Assembly in New York. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman stated, the U.S. government must take into account that it has definitive hosting responsibilities for the United Nations headquarters in New York. And regardless of its differences with countries, it has specific hosting responsibilities and must act within the framework. He also responded to another question regarding remarks by the U.S. Secretary of State and some European countries that the JCPOA talks will not remain open for a long time and that Iran have delayed the Vienna talks, saying, as a country that has caused many troubles in a criminal economic war against the Iranian nation, the United States is not in a position to talk about these issues. Khatibzadeh said, such a speculation that the nuclear negotiations have been concluded will not help the issue. On to another review by Meh News Agency, they say, Iran may return to Vienna talks with unrealistic demands. New York Times reported, the U.S. Special Representative for Iran's Affairs, Robert Malley, claimed that Iran may return to the seventh round of nuclear talks in Vienna with unrealistic demands. Robert Malley said, there is a real risk that they come back with unrealistic demands about what they can achieve in these talks. Meanwhile, a senior European official involved in Vienna talks said that if U.S. President Joe Biden is not elected for the next term, or a person like former U.S. President Trump is elected, there is a possibility that the United States will withdraw from Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. He added, if this event has happened once, it can be repeated again. Many observers believe that U.S. President Joe Biden is continuing former U.S. President Donald Trump's policy of maximum pressure on Iran. Our final piece of news is from Middle East Eye, which reads, U.S. urges Iran's Raisi to restart nuclear talks amid tensions over ship attack. The United States has urged Iran's new president to return to talks on the resumption of the 2015 nuclear deal, warning that the window for diplomacy would not stay open forever. State Department spokesman Ned Price told reporters that he hoped incoming President Ebrahim Raisi seizes the opportunity now to advance diplomatic solutions. Price said, "We are waiting to see, as I've mentioned before, the approach that the new government in Iran will take." He added, "For our part, we have made very clear that we are prepared to return to Vienna to resume negotiations." Iran initially continued to abide by the deal, but has reduced some of its commitments in recent months. During his swearing-in ceremony, Raisi said broad U.S. sanctions, which had triggered an economic recession and left inflation hovering at around 40%, must be lifted. "We will support any diplomatic plans that will achieve this goal," he said this while signaling a willingness to attend future negotiations in Vienna. That's it for me in today's edition. Back to you, Leila.
Talking of lawmaking and U.S. Congress, how would Iranians react? How have they reacted to congressional rejection of the JCPOA and U.S. efforts to strengthen sanctions? Well, by maintaining full commitment for a year, Iran has discredited America. And since reacting to Western inaction in executing the deal, it has gotten to bring its nuclear program back to life to increase nuclear capacity at a time when it would escape any criticism for doing so. Never mind the fact that the program is peaceful. The West is not sure of that.
You see, naturally, the media represent different political camps and can't be assessed and evaluated from a single point of view. Some media outlets are hostile to the Islamic Republic, whose agenda we all know. Persian-speaking media that are receiving substantial budgets from our enemies, intelligence services. The others are the mainstream media in the West, which have unfortunately violated their personal practices repeatedly in the past few years. Generally, it appears that Western media is being managed against Iran, which can't be looked at optimistically.
What entity exactly is Iran faced with? A unified U.S., U.S. Congress, the U.S. government?
I can confidently say that we don't recognize anything in international law other than the government. The American side, which comes forth for talks with Iran and participates in P5+1 meetings, must represent the entirety of the U.S. political establishment. The fact that they face limitations at home limits their negotiation power. But we don't accept that they commit to something that they would later say the U.S. government can't fulfill.
Iran started to partially reduce its commitments to the JCPOA in 2019 in accordance with paragraph 36 of the multilateral agreement. Paragraph 36 allows one side to stop complying with the deal if the other side is out of compliance. All being said, if sanctions are lifted, Iran will immediately reverse its decisions and enhancing its nuclear program.
It was within the same framework that Iran took steps to scale back his commitment to the deal a year after unilaterally staying committed to the accord. Tehran devised five steps that would reduce his commitments with prior notice. But in January 2020, there was a new development, the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani by the U.S. Iran, however, didn't take any new steps until a new parliament came into office. The new parliament has confronted the nuclear issue carefully since taking office. After a few months, Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was assassinated. Iran's parliament, that planned on activating the nuclear program, devised a guideline as a law to kickstart the issue in response to the destructive attitude of foreign parties. The law saw Iran starting uranium enrichment to a 20% purity level and the suspension of the voluntary implementation of the additional protocol.
Looking at how things are, Iran has actually gained strategic depth in deepening its partnership with Russia and China. Now it is neither possible to isolate Iran nor prudent to exercise the military option against this country.